And welcome to another SIPO seminar. We have today Svetlana Lebedenko, who I know for a couple of years now as someone who has done really interesting work around innovation policy in the Soviet Union, looking at a market system way of innovating and incentivizing innovation. So I think your PhD was mainly about that, right? So, and I think there's a book coming out at some point on that. So look forward to that. And today, Svetlana, who is now in Warwick, lecturing on law and tech and intellectual property, right? And so she's going to present to us a combination of the two, namely looking at intellectual property as a form of technology and to what extent maybe it shows traits or features of technology. So without any further ado, Svetlana, the floor is yours. I hope people online, you can hear us. There will be options for questions and answers. I think there's a Q&A function where you can post questions, which we will address after the talk. So for now, over to Svetlana. Thank you.
Good evening. I would like to start by thanking the SIPO community and Professor Henning Grosch-Roshan for this invitation. It is always a pleasure to be in Cambridge, and I'm truly honored to have this opportunity to share my work and engage in what I hope will be a stimulating conversation. My aim today is to introduce a technology perspective on intellectual property. Intellectual property has mainly been studied from institutional and systems perspectives. While both have produced useful insights into intellectual property, neither really explains the spread of this institution, which despite its numerous institutional failures, has never been rolled back. I want to put forward an argument about intellectual property and thinking of it as a technology in order to provide a macro-level explanation of this phenomenon of resilience. If we see intellectual property not simply as a set of legal rules, but as a technology, perhaps we could get a better grasp of this broader pattern. Let me begin with the context in which this puzzle of resilience arises. Intellectual property has become the main institution that most countries now rely on to manage their innovation systems. How this has happened is well known to this audience and has been well documented in the literature by the scholars who studied the international treaty-making processes and particularly the interest groups behind the drafting of the TRIPS agreement. The conventional design expectation of intellectual property is that this institution is necessary to foster and diffuse innovation. Specifically, that exclusive rights encourage investment in R&D, support disclosure of inventions, which would otherwise be kept secret, and foster technological progress. In other words, intellectual property has a clear functional purpose. And this narrative has become deeply embedded in the economic theory of IP rights, legal doctrine, and public policy. And it persists despite the lack of comprehensive evidence on whether IP functions as intended. At the same time, we see a growing evidence of failures of this institution, most dramatic of which happened during health emergencies. Also, there are ample examples of dysfunction in other sectors as well. IP can create barriers to entry in innovation markets, impede diffusion, raise cost of access to knowledge, or facilitate strategic behavior that runs against the public interest, such as patent raising. Several questions arise from this context. Why, despite these numerous institutional failures, does intellectual property continue to function as if nothing happened? What ingrains intellectual property as the default institution for knowledge governance, despite the lack of empirical evidence that it delivers its conventional design expectations? What makes governments, firms, and individuals continue to rely on this institution? What explains this phenomenon of resilience? To be clear, by intellectual property, I refer to information that's governed under the exclusivity rule, which includes the enforceable right to exclude others from using the information, the right to transfer that entitlement subject to statutory exceptions. The technology perspective that I present today concerns all forms of intellectual property in general, but I will primarily focus on patents as the strongest form of protection, with the understanding, however, that commercially valuable innovations are commonly covered by different forms of IP. It's important to add that considerable innovation also occurs outside formal intellectual property regimes. To examine the puzzle of IP's resilience, I first focus on the main perspectives that shaped our understanding of intellectual property, which include institutional, instrumental, and systems perspectives. I shall also show the limitations of these perspectives in addressing this puzzle of resilience. And then I'll introduce a technology perspective. The main theoretical basis of intellectual property comes from an instrumental perspective. Most arguments in favor of intellectual property originate from the continuity of justification of property rights and physical property and their role in economic growth. Patents are considered to encourage innovation by ensuring that fruits of socially desirable R&D efforts are protected from free riders. Many qualifiers shall be put in place for the instrumental perspective to hold. And intellectual property rights have more limitations than property rights, including the limited term of protection, the requirements of non-obviousness and disclosure, and such balancing of the patent holder's entitlement with the public interest goes back to the original justification of having this institution in the first place. There has been a serious and long-lasting critique of this perspective. From the 1930s, Arnold Klant argued that unlike property rights and physical property, patents do not result from scarcity. They create scarcity of the products that they appropriate. The result, according to Klant, is monopolistic price control and diversion of inventive resources to less socially productive activities. This line of critical argument continues to this day, and more studies find no correlation between strong intellectual property rights and innovation. The analytical limitation of the instrumental perspective is that it obscures the realities on the ground, realities that differ across countries and economic sectors. However, it is striking that the instrumental perspective persists despite the convincing critiques and empirical evidence calling it into question. The instrumental perspective has become embedded into the institutional design of intellectual property and operates as a cognitive frame for the epistemic community and for public policy more broadly. My argument today is not to say whether this design is valid or not, and much has been already said about this in the literature, but to show how, despite this sustained criticism, this instrumental perspective of intellectual property became generalized to the point of evolving into the presumption of efficiency of this institution. While the instrumental perspective on intellectual property explains its intended design, it says nothing about its performance in real world. That's where the institutional perspective becomes useful, as it contrasts IP's conventional design with reality. I rely on the definition of institution from Douglas Norris, which includes rules of the game in a society, or more formally, the humanly designed constraints that shape human interaction. The institution of intellectual property comprises both formal rules, legal norms, and informal constraints, practices, and conventions of interpretation surrounding the rules. The examples of the informal constraints include administrative practices of patent offices that, as you know, often assist patent applicants in redrafting patent formulas in order to get patents issued, and business practices of evergreening, when pharmaceutical patent owners aim to extend the exclusivity term beyond the statutory lens. The institutional perspective recognizes that institutions are not always efficient. Their design often serves the interest of those who have power to devise these rules. Strong players of the system influence the interpretation of formal rules, for example, the standard of novelty or the rule of disclosure in patent law. And informal constraints can also be strategically shaped. Think of the incentives for patent examiners to get patents issued. The institutional perspective highlights the problem of capture of both drafting the legal rules and shaping the informal constraints through interpretation and enforcement. It shows how the institution of intellectual property diverges from its conventional design purpose. However, the institutional perspective does not really explain why this divergence becomes normalized. Let me now briefly consider the system's perspective. A system comprises actors, for example, patent offices, multinational companies, local firms, universities, etc., and their interactions, including interactions in response to formal rules and related informal constraints. The formal rules can be similar in different countries, as this was facilitated by the TRIPS agreement, but the performance of these rules is shaped by how actors interact with these rules and with each other when applying them in practice. The advantage of the system perspective is that it focuses on the interaction rather than isolated rules. It identifies specific mechanisms such as economic coercion, forum shifting, and lobbying that enabled the spread of the institution of intellectual property. The system perspective also shows how these actors use intellectual property to pursue their goals within the system. Goals of excluding economic and political competitors and achieve significant market power. Uses that again diverge from the intended instrumental purpose of intellectual property. However, the system perspective doesn't say much about why this divergence becomes normalized if this institution consistently underperforms. The system's perspective value lies primarily in identifying the institutional weaknesses that countries might want to address to make full use of this institution. Common recommendations include capacity building, better coordination organizations administering these rules, and aligning intellectual property rules with the goals of development. The underlying assumption of the system's perspective is the reparability of the dysfunctional systems, and the domination of intellectual property is often taken for granted. Therefore, neither institutional nor systems perspective really explain how intellectual property achieves and sustains resilience. And this brings me to technology perspective. In technology studies, the concept of technology is not confined to physical artifacts. According to Giovanni Dossi, the definition also includes organizational routines, procedures for solving a problem or achieving a practical goal. Intellectual property, in a sense, is a set of organizational procedures that are designed to solve a problem of free writing, allowing innovators to code, their investments in R&D. It is this problem-solving orientation of intellectual property that makes it possible to conceptualize it as a technology. Technology is a useful analytical category. Foucault relied on the concept of technologies to examine the relationship between optimization and suppression. Vignualis refers to law as soft technology that has been neglected in the analysis of other hard technologies that constitute the Anthropocene. While the discourse on law and technology often juxtaposes these concepts, they can, and they do, overlap. Lessig has famously examined the phenomenon of technology acquiring the attributes of law. In a similar way, law as an entrenched, optimized social arrangement to solve a particular problem can acquire technological attributes. When we think about intellectual property in this broader sense, as a problem-solving technology designed to govern the use of knowledge, its historical development and the contemporary dominance begin to look very much like those of other technologies. Technologies that evolved from initially multiple designs into mature, entrenched technologies. Historically, the earliest forms of IP were nothing like broad, transferable, exclusive rights that we see today. They were limited, exceptional privileges. Many countries experimented with either opt-outs or with alternatives. Well into the 19th century, Switzerland and the Netherlands abolished patents entirely in order to accelerate their industrial development for several decades. In the 20th century, the USSR relied on inventor certificates in parallel with patents. In other words, technologies for knowledge governance were once considerably more varied, and intellectual property was far less pervasive. The decisive change occurred with the adoption of the TRIPS Agreement. The TRIPS Agreement, as this audience knows very well, linked intellectual property to international trade, established global minimum standards, and created an enforcement mechanism that significantly constrained regulatory policy space. The space for experimentation narrowed dramatically. IP became standardized, compulsory, global, and general-purpose technology. With regards to the general purpose, think, for example, of the non-discrimination rules for patents and the extent to which firms now rely on IP. At this point, intellectual property began to operate as a technological template, a design that was exported, replicated, and deeply embedded across innovation systems. Before I turn into the technology perspective in greater detail, I shall note that technology studies themselves offer several distinct theories. The three main approaches, instrumental, substantive, and critical, provide a useful map for situating different ways in which intellectual property is understood. The instrumental theory captures the mainstream understanding of technology, which is shared by most social scientists and policymakers. This perspective treats technology as a neutral means towards an end, a tool whose purpose is to enhance efficiency. When applied to intellectual property, this theory aligns almost perfectly with the mainstream instrumental perspective on intellectual property. Behind the instrumental thinking about technology in general and intellectual property in particular is the same idea of the benefit of progress. IP is assumed to be a set of routines that increases innovation output, and therefore we shall adapt to it and fine-tune, but not fundamentally challenge. And this is the view that dominates contemporary IP discourse. Opposite to that is the substantive theory of technology, often associated with technological determinism. Here, technology is not seen as neutral at all. If we look at intellectual property through the substantive lens, we find the arguments calling for significant reduction or even abolition of IP rights. And these are not new. Critics from the 19th century onwards, through to contemporary Baldwin and Levin, have questioned whether the patent system is efficient, socially justified, or even necessary, suggesting that it may function more as an instrument of control rather than of progress. However, abolishing an already existing and entrenched system is often seen as too radical to implement. It's always safer, to quote Fritz Machlop's report to the US Congress, to muddle through the system if it's already there. Hence, the main discourse on intellectual property gravitates towards the instrumental view of technology. It is less destabilizing to adapt to the existing system than to enter the unknown. Finally, the critical theory of technology advanced by Andrew Finberg sits between the instrumental and substantive theories. This school is not critical of progress and does not suggest phasing out of technology. Instead, it invites us to question the assumptions of neutrality and efficiency of technology. Assumptions, as I mentioned, constitute the basis for the mainstream instrumental understanding of technology. Technologies from the critical perspective are neither inevitable nor immutable. Applied to intellectual property, this perspective encourages us to interrogate the underlying assumptions of neutrality and efficiency that sustain intellectual property, and to consider how democratic input and alternative designs might reshape the governance of knowledge. The critical theory of technology proves especially useful to explain the phenomenon of IP's resilience. The assumptions of neutrality and efficiency serve as anchors of the technology and make it easier to resist critique or empirical evidence, as such evidence is framed as an anomaly rather than a problem of its underlying design. Studies that aim to explain how technology evolves and diffuses are also relevant here. And I find Dose's work in particular on technological paradigms particularly suitable for intellectual property. The notion of technology implies problem-solving activities involving also tacit forms of knowledge embodied in individuals and organizations. Technological paradigms also entailed shared cognitive frames and common patterns in solving a particular problem among the practitioners working within the same paradigm. And intellectual property requires organizational support. Support from specialized courts, patent attorneys, and other IP practitioners who know how to navigate the rule complexity within the existing conventions of interpretation of these rules. These routines and feedback loops reinforce one another, deepening IP's entrenchment and making alternatives more difficult to imagine, let alone implement. Intellectual property is therefore subject to the same dynamics that scholars observe in relation to other entrenched technologies. The instrumental perspective on intellectual property as a problem-solving technology functions as a technological paradigm. The assumptions of neutrality and efficiency anchor intellectual property as the principal technology for knowledge governance and make instrumental theoretical perspective resilient to empirical evidence of its dysfunction. The evolutionary nature of technology implies that once technology becomes firmly established, any changes that occur to this technology will often be incremental and bound by the existing technological paradigm. And we see that any changes to intellectual property in various jurisdictions are minor and bound by the current paradigm grounded in the exclusivity model. A technological perspective, therefore, can provide a macro-level explanation of the phenomenon of intellectual property resilience. And this perspective also helps to identify where meaningful reform might originate. If IP resilience arises from its technological attributes, then altering specific legal rules will not be sufficient. Change must engage the underlying assumptions, the neutrality and efficiency theses, and make visible the political and institutional choices embedded within them. It must create space for alternative knowledge governance systems, such as open science models, commons-based approaches, or incentive mechanisms that do not rely on exclusivity. And in line with a critical theory of technology, it must broaden democratic engagement, allowing a wider range of actors to participate in defining the objectives and designing these better alternatives. Thank you very much.